Okay, well, good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to UEA. Welcome to this capacity building event, create event. My name is Morten Veer. I'm the director of the Centre for Competition Policy, which is located just across the street, and which is part of organising these two days we're going to have talking about the economics of creativity and competition. Well, you can see what we do. There are lots of stuff downstairs about what the Centre for Competition Policy is. So if you're interested in that, do pick up some of the aftertaste and get home with you. I just want to say, apart from welcoming you, just say that we haven't yet seen the second speaker. That creates a certain level of anxiety amongst the organising crowd, but also those of us who are speaking. We will pretend that he's coming, and if he's not coming, we'll just move you forward, and then we will have a slightly longer coffee break and probably start Joel a bit earlier so that we finish a little bit earlier, give you more time to get back to where you're staying and to have a quick drink or something. So welcome, everybody, and I'll hand over to Piers Fleming, who's going to chair the first session.
Yep, thank you. Yes, so I'm Piers Fleming, and I'm going to chair the session on From Creativity to Market, without further ado, I've got great pleasure in introducing Ruth Towers, who's going to tell us about copyright and creativity incentive and reward.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for inviting me. It's nice to be here, and I hope I've got something to say of interest to you all. I'm giving a talk, so I'm afraid I work from a script, my own script. So, by way of introduction, I want to say it would not seem right to start a conference on creativity and competition without at least a mention of Joseph Schumpeter. Now, this is going to be a challenge for me, as my talk is on copyright and creativity, and Schumpeter made no mention at all of copyright, despite his interest in patents. At least that is according to my husband, late husband, Mark Blaug, who wrote a paper on why did Schumpeter not write on creativity, on copyright. I should say that, like all historians of economic thought, Mark had somewhat of a crush on Schumpeter, who, as you probably know, is a very much larger-than-life figure. Nor do I think that Schumpeter referred to creativity, using that word anyway, but I think we can interpret his views on product and process innovation in that way. Now, Schumpeter has entered the canon of writers so famous that no one needs to read him anymore to know what he wrote. And I will freely confess that I think I probably fall into that category as well. In our soundbite era, Schumpeter has been reduced mostly to one phrase, which is perennial gales of creative destruction. There's less interest in his more soundbite idea of swarms of innovation, technological developments that he believed took place very quickly at a particular time. Schumpeter, of course, distinguished product and process innovation and placed more emphasis on adoption and the use of products and processes than on their invention, which I think is important for our subject. He emphasized the role of the market in the introduction of new products and techniques of production, seeing the market as a process of ongoing creative discovery with the entrepreneur as the linchpin. The entrepreneur is responsible for new forms of industrial organization, sources of supply and vision and risk-taking, which have been described also as an aspect of creativity. Now, I won't sidestep on that to go into a publication that the UN organisations have done on the creative economy. But, I mean, one of the things that they regard as creative in that is entrepreneurship. Anyway, this market process results in endogenous growth. And, of course, much has been written on endogenous growth in economics these days. The other side to the Schumpeterian worldview is the role of competition, the creative destruction part. The market, like Shiva, destroys as well as creates. Entrepreneurs who don't adapt to change go to the wall. Failure to innovate is weeded out by the market, and I think, having said all this brief introduction to what most economists would know about anyway, I think we can all agree that Schumpeter would have been very interested in the creative industries. Now, given the emphasis in policy circles on creativity and growth, we need to ask how these processes work in the creative industries. So what I want to do in this talk is to dwell on the role of copyright in the creative process as developed in cultural economics and relate it to my own ongoing research on copyright and business models in music publishing. As a result, it's caused me to revisit work I did in the 1990s on incentives and rewards in the music industry, comparing two different modes of reward, that is royalties and flat fee buyouts. So this leads us straight into the notion of contracts, into the idea of contracts, and allows me to harp on my favourite string. Copyright is one thing, copyright law is one thing, and how it works for creators, by whom I mean the people who actually produce the new pieces of work, depends on the contract that they have with the entrepreneur, that is the publisher, record label, filmmaker, and so on. Cultural economics, I'm turning now to the topic of artist labour markets. Cultural economics, which is the field I've worked in for the last 25 years or so, is concerned with creativity in two senses. One is the output of diverse and novel cultural goods, and secondly, in their supply by creators. So there's the output and also the product and also the process of their production. Cultural economics has a long-standing research record of analysing artists' labour markets, and I'll summarise some of this work before moving on to the question of incentives and rewards in copyright contracts. I see this as a particular aspect of entrepreneurship in the creative industries. And this research ties in neatly with copyright as an incentive, as I discuss later. So the literature in cultural economics on creativity has focused on artist labour markets. Creators in this literature are known as artists, but they include performers, craftspeople, as well as creative artists such as composers and writers. So it's just the term that's used in this particular discipline. Some of these people are employed, which is, I think, important to remember. They're employed and go to work in factories, in inverted commas, to write songs, develop games, draw cartoons, and so on. Some enterprises are creative in the sense that the entrepreneur organises the production of these goods by hiring these people, paying them, and so on. However, the emphasis in cultural economics has been on creativity by individuals working freelance on their own account, often financed by themselves and their families or their families. These artists themselves are often entrepreneurs, though not often recognised as such, because we cling to the romantic view of the poet in the garret as being the artist, one that I would argue is also incorporated in copyright law. Now, work in cultural economics has covered, on artist labour markets, has covered three main areas: motivation and incentives, earnings and hours worked, and training and career development, which I'm not going to say anything about. Much of the work has been done through surveys, because official statistics on artists are very unsatisfactory and remain so. Though, in general, I think official creative industry data is improving. I've been working on creative industries since, mid-1990s, and I think that it really is the case that this data are much, much improved these days. Economists have not been interested in what we might call the creative spark, and nor is copyright, by the way, but instead on the factors that affect the supply of artworks, usually measured in terms of the time that they spend on arts, non-arts work, searching for jobs, and, of course, unemployment. Now, artists' labour markets are characterised by two main features: superstardom and excess supply, two ends, might say, of the so-called long tail, though that term is ambiguous because it's in use in many different ways. Superstars are talented creators and performers who earn disproportionately high earnings, i.e. economic rent. And by contrast, excess supply is the large number of entrants to artistic professions who seek work at low or even zero rates of payment. Now, I should emphasise here that empirical work on artists' labour markets has always sought to establish that the subjects are professional in the sense of having sold, performed, or displayed work for payment, to distinguish them from the many people who would like to be artists, who try to be artists, who call themselves artists but don't actually get any professional rent payment or something. Payment, because we're economists. Okay. It does not regard anyone who has graduated from art college or its equivalent as a professional artist. And I think this is an important part because there is quite a literature on what are called creatives, who are people who have been at art college and so on, but who, for reasons that won't surprise anybody, are unable to find work or succeed in the arts. And that much has been made of the cultural economics are stuck to the guys who are actually making some money at it. There have been a host of surveys of artists in diverse parts of the world, from Finland to Australia, and all find very similar results. One of which, incidentally, is that many practicing artists have not had any training in art, so that a lot of people who go into the arts actually go in from other fields, and so there's a two-way process. People who've trained in an arts program as artists or performers or something, we have to move out of the artist labour market, and then other people move in from, being economists who try to be singers. You know, there are one or two people like that. The findings of these surveys are well known. The median artist's annual income is lower than that of workers with equivalent educational qualifications. They experience bouts of unemployment, though as actually many are self-employed, this isn't strictly correct to say that, but I think you know what I mean. They work fewer hours than they would like to work in their chosen artistic occupation because they cannot earn a basic income from it. And most are multiple job holders. They switch the time they allocate between their arts and non-arts work in accordance with the relative wage rates. When the imputed wage rate for arts work rises, they work more hours on arts work. When the wage rate of non-art work rises, they work fewer hours in it and switch to working more hours in arts work. So thus, supply is backward bending in relation to non-arts work. Now, this theory is called the work preference model of artists and was developed by my colleague and, to some extent, mentor, David Throsby. The other finding that's important in this context is that artists are always also responsive to arts, to grants, awards, and so on, in terms of their time spent in the arts. So I think this naturally leads to a discussion of motivation. Another senior colleague of mine, Bruno Frey, has applied what he calls crowding theory based on social psychology of motivation to artists' incentives and reward. Motivation is both intrinsic and extrinsic, and reward is accordingly. Intrinsic motivation must be matched with intrinsic reward, otherwise it could be crowded out by extrinsic reward, such as money. This raises questions about the best way to organise and finance creativity so as to offer the most efficient incentive system. Intrinsic motivation and extrinsic reward, however, might meet in certain conditions, for example, in prizes or awards that are judged by their peers. And I have argued in a paper that I'm not going to refer to anymore, that they also meet in copyright law. So turning to copyright and creativity, Copyright lays claims to being an incentive to creativity and emphasises the rights of authors, while also creating related rights for publishers and others, for example, performers. It sets a very low standard for creativity, unlike, say, an arts council offering a grant. It's understandable that that is the case, as otherwise courts would have to judge quality in art. Copyright is a market-based reward system that mainly operates through extrinsic reward, i.e. the so-called economic rights. However, moral rights are important to artists because they offer intrinsic reward in the form of recognition and status. One of the main reasons why many artists support copyright, even though they know that they obtain little in the way of financial income from it. Those who argue that copyright can be replaced by grants and prizes, you know, we can all think of some people who've gone down that route. They're not far wrong in that respect, which is that grants and prizes are a strong motivation. And of course, this has been argued in the legal literature, whether moral rights have economic incentives and so on and so forth. However, research in artists' labour market nowadays also includes surveys on earnings from copyright, which show that copyright earnings are typically very low. Unsurprisingly, they follow the same highly skewed distribution as that for fees and wages, so it would not be uncommon to find that 90% of earnings go to 10% of recipients. And we get this from Martin Kretschmer, as you probably know, has done work on this, and so on. Royalties are essentially a pig in a poke. They are an ex post reward with little ex ante information except the contracted royalty rate, making informed decision very difficult. Earnings are unpredictable for the artist as well as for the publisher and depend on the price of the final product over which the artist mostly has no control. In fact, the grandiose claims made for copyright as an incentive fail to take into account the fact that it's not the law or even the market that decide the reward, but the contractor, or the contract between the creator and the publisher. So I now want to turn to copyright contracts. Contracts and contracting have grown exponentially as a topic of interest to economists since Coase first questioned the nature of the firm. The firm is a nexus of contracts, principal agent analysis, asymmetric information, opportunistic behaviour with and without guile are all very familiar in the creative industries. Richard Caves wrote a whole book on contracts in the creative industries, arguing that contract theory explains their economic organisation, since investors require the transfer of property rights to prevent hold-ups, control costs and secure maximum returns. Indeed, Caves is one of the few theories that offer an economic basis for treating the creative industries as a sector with common features. Now, of course, in dealings between the creator and the firm in these industries, the property rights that are transferred are mostly copyrights. Nowadays, the contract typically involves the transfer of all economic rights in exchange for a commitment to pay a royalty based on sales revenue, which the artist receives some months after publication. There's no guarantee in the contract that the work is kept in print or plastic, and the rights may be sold on without the creator's permission. Copyrights become firms' assets that are traded in mergers and acquisitions. There are alternatives to the royalty contract. In some markets, a buyout of all rights for a single payment is adopted, which I discuss later. I'm going to come on in a few minutes to music publishing, where this still does occur. Moreover, if creative work is undertaken as part of a contract of employment, the contract anyway belongs to the employer. The film industry learned very early on of the potential for holdups if rights are retained. Another variant on the royalty contract is the option contract, in which the artist or author agrees to offer any new work to the publisher, who, however, does not commit to publishing, necessarily commit to publishing it. So in all these ways, I think it's plain that the publisher acts as the principal and the artist as the agent, rather than the other way round. Now, of course, this would be reversed if you were Pavarotti or, well, he's dead, isn't he? Jonas Kaufmann is the latest stunning superstar tenor, or if you're Madonna, no doubt that you would act as the principal and regard the record industry, record label, as your agent. But that's very unusual. Simply having copyright protection neither guarantees a fair deal nor earnings for the majority of artists, with the exception of these few superstars. Why? Well, success for even established artists is radically uncertain. Talent is unpredictable, and there is an ever-present oversupply of would-be entrants that are a threat to existing artists and an opportunity to the publisher. So, one of the first questions that an economist asks on first contact with a royalty contract is this: why not go for a buyout? Why mess about with this long-winded royalty arrangement? Why not take the money and run? When this is mentioned to any artist, they think you must be crazy or out to get them or working from the record industry or something. The answer is, of course, complex, and I have thought a lot about this and written quite a bit about it. But at bottom, what it boils down to is what Adam Smith called the overweening conceit of the young. In other words, in more contemporary terms, asymmetric information about artists. The artist has a strong belief, this is part of the intrinsic motivation, has a strong belief in her creativity, but cannot estimate the financial side, while investors or entrepreneurs require the highest return. Sorry, not entrepreneurs, that's a naughty mistake in relation to Schumpeter, isn't it? Sorry. The investors require the highest possible return on capital, and the capital market is well known, and so they can get their information much more easily. So it's I think the asymmetry of the information is a very important aspect in this. Well, finally, I'd like to apply some of these points briefly to the UK music publishing industry. The traditional role of the music publisher was as intermediary between composer, performer, and audience, and involved producing sheet music. Without the works, the idea of the composer had to be translated into some legible form for the performer to perform, and then without the performer performing, which might have also been a consumer, of course, people would not be able to hear the music. Music publishers nowadays see their main role as managing rights for composers, or songwriters, let's just call them composers. They could also be described as traders in creative commodities, that is, copyrights in music. And there is a big trade in these things. The creative activity of a music publisher takes place in the A&R department, A&R being artist and repertoire, the equivalent of R&D in technical technology. And they seek out new talent which matches writers with performers and outlets, such as recordings or live performance. These processes require capital to be put up front. In former times, for the printing and marketing of sheet music, nowadays for producing demo tapes, organising contracts. Introducing novelties was the term that was always used for new songs throughout the 18th and 19th and early 20th century, was always risky. According to Boosey in the 1930s, Boosey, who was a partner in Boosey and Hawkes, said 1 in 40 succeeded. Record industry said 1 in 8 or 1 in 10, I can't remember exactly. So pooling risk has always been necessary in music publishing. Though risk is nowadays reduced by the fact that a new writer would have a track record of success, for example, on YouTube. Music publishers also have to compete for new works with A&R in record companies, And the rights management function, which I could talk about later, but I won't have time now, is also under pressure as new publishers are developing bespoke data systems, which is quite an interesting development. With the development of the standard royalty contract, which was roughly after 1930, before that it was nearly all buyouts, the composer is asked to take a considerable share of the risk. Before that, however, buyouts were the norm in the UK, particularly for lyrics and songs, and songs were traditionally the most valuable part of music publishing. Until the 1910s, the business model for music publishers was sales, 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 and some hires. New works were advertised by plugging, which I guess Joel knows better as payola, but I think we all know what it means, paying a singer or band leader to introduce a new work in a music hall or concert. And also, another form of advertisement was for the music publisher to promote concerts producing that consisted entirely of their own novelties. The idea being, of course, that once this had been advertised, people would go out and buy the sheet music to perform at home. The performing right, though part of copyright law from the 1840s, was barely collected until the 20th century. Because music publishers concentrated on sales as their business model, and the performing right was regarded as a disincentive to the plugger. Accordingly, sales and hires were the only source of revenue. But with the growth of sound recording and the 1911 Copyright Act, which, by the way, was an imperial act, so India and South Africa and all these other countries had the same act, some of which have only just been changed, I think, in one or two outlying outposts. Mechanical royalties became part of the 1911 Act and provided a new source of revenue to publishers and composers through recording. And the Music Publishers Association was very quick to set up the mechanical MCPS, the Mechanical Collection Protection Society. I've got it wrong way around, but anyway, MCPS. The Performing Rights Society, which dealt with performing rights, was founded mainly by composers. I think this is important. People think that it was set up by the publishers. No, it wasn't. It was the composers that wanted to collect the performing right. In 1914 it was set up, but revenues were not really significant, partly because a lot of music publishers did not join it until the 20s, and also when the BBC signed up and became popular, it became an important source of revenue. So by the Second World War, effectively, there were three main sources of revenue for composers and music publishers. The composers' and songwriters' share of the royalties from each of these sources depends on the contract with the publisher, which will determine the split of revenues. That might also be determined within, say, the Copyright Collecting Society. There was a statutory arrangement for mechanical rights and so on and so forth. Again, this is detail that we don't need to know much about, I think, or we don't know much about, in fact. Nowadays, synchronization rights, which are an aspect of synchronization rights, are the rights to play music along with a moving image. So they're becoming increasingly valuable due to the growth of TV stations, games, and other internet activities. They are often negotiated directly between the composer and the film company, if a film company is involved, without involving a publisher. However, it's also the case that all rights may be bought out by a production company, a production music company that produces what's called library music. So that we still have the buyout model that is working, and by the way, it's also true for performers, for dance records and that sort of thing. Okay, so the division of all this depends on on the contracts, and not only the contracts between the publisher and the composer, but also between the publisher and sub-publishers, because the music industry is absolutely riddled with sub-publishing deals. So in the last couple of minutes, I'll just draw my conclusion. Excuse me. How creators are motivated and rewarded, and how their work is channeled to the market, matters for growth in the creative industries. Copyright law is essentially endogenized through contracts, which are determined by the entrepreneurs. I think this leads to a question that we might discuss, which is, how exogenous is copyright law? A topic for future research is certainly how digitization has affected contracts and creators' earnings. There is sketchy hearsay evidence on this, I haven't seen anything very compelling. For example, the long tail, original long tail stuff is really based on hunches. For what it's worth, my hunch is that earnings distributions are going to become even more skewed as such as superstars and media corporations get bigger. But success might, in fact, be shorter lived. So I'm not sticking my neck out as a real prediction, it's a hunch, but hunches can be tested. There are other systems of incentives and rewards for creators other than copyright, each with its own drawbacks. Publicly funded grants are bureaucratic, prizes can be biased. One of my colleagues in cultural economics has done a lot of work on competitions, biasing competitions, and so on. There is no perfect set system of incentive and reward for creativity, and the mixture of sources is probably best. Though the industry, or the music industry, is dominated by three large corporations for publishing, there are still many smaller publishing houses and new entries. So there is, in fact, plenty of choice for the songwriter and composer. So in that way, competition is important to creativity in music publishing. Music publishing is a profitable industry and has been so for centuries. It goes back, after all, to about 1650, around then. Product innovation, the development of new works or new ways of exploiting old ones, is the source of its survival, resting on a business model that relies entirely on copyright. Thus, one can say that copyright and creativity go hand in hand. Copyright is endogenized via contracts, which depend on market forces for incentive and reward. But the heavy reliance on copyright law surely challenges the Schumpeterian view of the role of entrepreneurship as the vital force for growth. And there has been, I should say as a footnote, there has been very little technological innovation in the music publishing business. So it's all been process product and not process innovation. Thank you very much.
We've got 5 minutes for questions now, if anyone's got any questions for you. I have a question.
Well done. Well done, Chair.
Thank you. I was wondering what effect self-publishing might have had in recent years, whether it's had any real effect, and what, if you could perhaps speculate about what it might have in the future, if any.
There are various options for self-publishing, which I think are particularly relevant to the film industry. Because film composers nowadays can use software. I mean, don't forget that, let's go back to the old model of music publishing. The old model of music publishing to produce sheet music meant that works had to be edited, they had to be copied in properly, and then they had to be engraved on plates to be pressed, to be printed. All that process now can be done, well, apart from the engraving, but you can just do it on a photocopier, right? All of that process can now be done using one of the standard one of the standard packets that you can buy. There's one called Sibelius, for obvious reasons. I can't remember the names of all of them, but there are a number of these. So particularly for film composers, it means they can work at home. They can even play back so they can hear what it sounds like when, you know, because all this technology can also produce sounds. So they can supply their commission straight to the filmmaker without any need for this intervention. Now, some of them do, anyway, publish these things. But so this is a sign of the way things could go. Things are slightly oddly going in the other direction with some recorded music that isn't written down. Because, of course, there are bands creating music that isn't written down. And so there are people sitting in, I think it's Faber and Faber, I can't remember. There are people sitting, trained musicians, who can listen to the record, you know, the Justin Bieber or something, and then produce a piano version of his music, then sell to, or guitar version, which are then sold to people. So there's still a market for sheet music. It constitutes about 8%, I think, of income of music publishers. But I suspect a lot of it goes to educational grade, piano grade things and so on, which is not to be sniffed at. There's quite a big, I should think it's quite a big industry. But that doesn't really answer your question. I mean, of course, I think there is sub-publishing. I mean, I think, you just have to ask yourself, what's the most important thing? Is it the connections that are made with record companies? Is it the opportunities for concert performances, for concerts themselves? I think it's a bit early to say. I mean, I don't think there's been so much. Well, maybe somebody knows of work on these. You guys doing your PhD are more likely to know about this than oldies like myself, who have to catch up slowly. You know, anybody know of this? I mean, there's been quite a lot of work on pricing of digital things and questioning whether or not the author is getting more return than they used to. I edited a book called The Copyright, what was it called? Digital Creative Economy. Is that what it's called? Something like that. Which has articles, chapters in it that deal with some of these topics. I mean, obviously people have tried to speculate whether digitization is fundamentally altering some of these industries. But it's still, I think, fairly early days. But Joel will know far more about it than me.
Sean? Yes, I was just wondering what caused or what explains that shift then in the contract from being a fixed payment predominantly in the pre-war period to a royalty payment now?
Well, I think largely, well, two things from my understanding of it. One is that music sales started to fall anyway. By about the First World War. And so sales revenues were falling. And music publishers got very worked out about it. I may say that until 1906, there was rampant piracy in sheet music, which was only effectively stopped in 1906, although there'd been a number of acts of parliament that had tried to deal with it before. They'd never coordinated properly the enforcement, let's just call it that, how it was enforced. I mean, at one time they had to be able to seize all the copies and show them to the court and that sort of thing. So there had been a lot of piracy. And music publishers, some of them responded around the 1900s by saying, if you can't beat them, join them, so we'll lower our prices. But as you know, Sean, I'm sure as a political economist and no doubt very cognizant of economic history, prices were very even all the way through the late 19th century. So a sheet, piece of sheet music was like 2 shillings that went on from sort of like 1880 and right through. But sales began to fall, and when sales revenue began to fall on the one hand, so they were looking to other opportunities. And of course, partly the reason why sales revenue was the onset of sound recording. Although I find it hard to believe that sound recording was a very strong threat much before the First World War, but we could think about that. But then the Performing Rights Society was formed in 1914. And without a collecting society, it would be impossible to collect for the rights. Although, with grand rights, I mean, the whole theatrical story, which I haven't really dealt with, I mean, was also quite important. I mean, and still is, by the way, what you get from if your work is included in a theatrical performance. And these are called the grand rights that are used for operas and musicals and so on. And performing, you could have, they were collecting those before the performing rights, and they got through other live concerts. So live performance outside theatres, I should say. So composers did know you could collect for the number of performances that your work experienced. So there was a sort of information on, and playwrights did it as well. So there had been some collection of these royalties. And some of the contracts I've seen for people like Arthur Sullivan and so on from the 1890s were including a royalty payment, which, by the way, was denominated not in a percentage terms, but in pennies. So they got tuppence or threepence. And the other thing, by the way, is they didn't get paid the royalty on every copy. There was a rule called 13 in 12, which means you got paid for 12 and there were 13 copies. But, you know, I mean, so I think that's, does that answer your question? More than you expected or wanted, no doubt.
Okay, time for one more question. You can pick.
Well, you pick, you're the chairman. Oh. I think Mika got his hand up first.
Sorry,
me? Yeah, you. Right. It's your big day.
Right. So you said with the prediction that there will be sort of more, I guess, larger superstars, but less of them. I was kind of hoping with YouTube, for example, that there might be more of these, not necessarily superstars, but a lot of these sort of almost self-made musicians that could publish their own music.
Well, from what I know, which I don't claim this, you know, I'm not really an expert on this. Not sure I'm an expert on much anyway, but haven't worked on this. And it's a bit early days for testing. As far as one knows, quite a lot of these people who are successful do go through the corporate system. I mean, they may start off with YouTube and then move into getting a record contract or something. But anyway, be an interesting topic for you to research, wouldn't it?
Well, I guess so, yeah.
Well, why not? I mean, it is obviously one of the things that needs researching that would fit in very well. This is, I hope, from my presentation, that fits into a whole literature that exists already and how to do it and so on. So.
Okay. Thank you very much.